Molecular biology has unleashed nightmares and wonders. Genetic engineering, the Human Genome Project, even cloning. All made possible by two young men, Francis Crick and James Watson. They were in their 20s when they cracked the code for DNA and won the Nobel Prize. James Watson is in his mid-70s now. He runs the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and he recently came out with a sequel to his classic memoir, The Double Helix. The new book is Genes, Girls, and Gamow. Steve Paulson asked Watson if he felt like a celebrity after his great discovery in 1953.
No, certainly not a celebrity. In that spring of 53, a number of people came, several carloads of people from Oxford, to see the double helix. But no one asked Francis and I to give a talk in Cambridge. I went up to Edinburgh and gave a talk there.
I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, that would not happen today. I mean, today you would immediately be heralded as a great scientist of your time. I guess things were just different then.
It was different and it was smaller. And certainly in England, understatement was the way to success. It was obvious. It was important. You didn't have to say it. I mean, that was a sort of Cambridge snobbish way. It was so important you don't have to say it.
How old were you at the time when you made the discovery?
24, but a month later, by the time the paper was published, I was 25.
That's phenomenal that you were so young when you made that discovery.
When I was a graduate student, the physicist turned biologist, Max Delbruck, he was always talking about 25 was the make or break year. Einstein was 25. Heisenberg was 25. You had the brain to do it. It was just, did you have the resources? Mm-hmm. And, of course, in some cases, the education. But in new fields, you don't have to learn that much.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to have a right objective.
Now, what struck me as I read your book was how scientists from various disciplines used to hang out together and sometimes work together. There were theoretical physicists, there were ornithologists, as well as molecular biologists, and intellectually, it must have been a very rich environment.
Well, as one of the ornithologists, I always felt somewhat inferior when the
You were actually an ornithologist at a certain point.
Yeah, that was my object from probably the age 10 until 16 or 17, age 17. Then I was at the University of Chicago, and I wanted to go into genetics and find out what the gene was.
Hmm.
But I had gone to the University of Chicago after 2 years of high school. I was 15, so I didn't think much about being young. It was just a fact of life, and the way to succeed was to, try and move in circles of people who were 5 to 10 years older than I was.
Tell me about the Russian physicist who was known as Geo, who's a major figure in your book.
George Gamow. We called him not Geo, Joe.
Oh, sorry.
Joe Gamow, but of course he wrote it in his own G-E-O. In those days, you don't hear about today, but the brightest people were the physicists, particularly the theoretical physicists. They were known to be eccentric. They couldn't think all the time, so they either were musicians or, in Gamow's case, he became a writer and expert at cards and all sorts of tricks. He was trying to amuse himself.
Now, speaking of brilliant physicists, you also knew Richard Feynman from Caltech. What was he like?
Oh, real bright. No nonsense. Dick used to say how hard doing science was. Once I caught him at lunch, and he was reading the Saturday Evening Post, a story. And I would never read a Saturday Evening Post story. And he said, he just liked stories with happy endings, and he didn't want anything complicated out of literature. If he was going to use his brain, he was going to use it on physics and not literature. I tried to read more difficult literature knowing I couldn't do the more difficult science.
Hmm. I'm struck by what you just said a moment ago, that especially the physicists couldn't use their brain all the time doing science. They had to do other stuff as well. I mean, it almost suggests a certain way the brain works.
Well, when you're doing experiments, it's very repetitive, mindless for most of the time. But thinking, actually, is hard work. So if you're trying to do high-powered mathematics or equations, most people can't do it all day. Just like if you're a writer, you can't do that all day. You could write 4 hours a day. That's about all I can do. And then you've got to relax.
Now, one thing I'm willing to bet that you have thought about a lot over the years is what is the optimal environment to produce scientific discoveries? What kind of workplace really inspires creativity? Have you come to any conclusions?
It should be a place filled with bright people. And they should largely be young, because being with, a collection of bright older people, they're sort of pleased with themselves. The younger people aren't as fixed on, old ideas. And you have to have people who aren't, so concerned with failure, which again is young. Mm-hmm. If failing knocks you out of the game, then you'll do something which you can succeed on. So I think in ideal circumstances where there are some people who know you're bright and who will protect you if your idea just goes nowhere. I mean, they can't protect you forever, but you'd like to be in a lab where the head of the lab believes in your objective and isn't competing with you. The Cavendish, when I went there in 1951, was just perfect. There was no stupidity. It was well-equipped. And the person in charge wanted us to succeed.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say this, because it seems to me you've just described what's wrong with university life, because, of course, it's the older people there who are most established. And also, if you fail when you're young, you're not going to get tenure.
Yeah. In my case, you see, I was started at 23. If I failed, I wasn't worried about tenure. I wasn't married. I think younger people are less worried about failure. But you have to have a solid structure on top to protect the young, sort of non-competing parents or grandparents. Mm-hmm. I think the main thing is that you shouldn't be competing with your elders. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're necessarily going to be competing with people your own age, but I think it's sort of dangerous when people on top feel threatened by people below.
And you would say the competition is important. I mean, to be vying against your peers, that's a part of what makes great science.
It makes you go faster. And also you learn through having other people around. I mean, finally, it was the appearance of Linus Pauling, who we knew wanted to understand DNA, that sort of threw Francis and I into a one-month frenzy, which came up with the answer. If he hadn't been there, we would have, I probably played more tennis that spring. And, not thought of the need, it's now or never.
And, of course, Linus Pauling at that time was the great chemist of the world and an older generation, and he was one of the great scientists of his time.
Oh, he seemed very old. He was 50, so he was, almost 25 years younger than I am now. So it's a hard thing to, but when you're in your early 20s, people 40 seem pretty old.
Now, the way
I think an essential thing is you should be in a place where you can still learn. And I sort of had a rule, never be the brightest person in a room, because you're in the wrong room if you're the brightest person, because no one can help you when you're in trouble. And if you're trying something hard, you're probably going to be in trouble, which Cambridge University in the early 50s was probably the best university in the world, particularly in what we were trying to do. There were a number of people who knew more than Francis Crick, and he could go and ask them for advice.
And yet they were not the ones who made the discovery of the double helix. You and he did.
Well, we had the objective. They were trying to solve other problems, which in retrospect were less important. So we had the good problem, but we didn't, know enough. In fact, we should have got the answer in a couple months. We didn't go around and ask for enough advice. And in a couple cases, we'd have probably got the wrong advice. Finally, someone from California arrived from Pauling's lab and spotted that the formulas were drawn in the wrong way in a book, and that was it. So, he came to Cambridge because he wanted to be with bright people. Well, I went to Cambridge because I wanted to be with bright people. So you want to go to a place where you think it's the best. I think that's the rule, Just to always go to the best place you can get to.
James Watson talking with Steve Paulson. 50 years ago, Watson and Francis Crick discovered the double helix, the structure of DNA.